The story of Israeli intelligence is a story of unbelievable series of tactical successes, but at the same time of a dangerous political strategic failure.
Ronen Bergman and the secret history of Israel's targeted assassinations, coming up on In Contrast. I'm Ilan Stavans, and In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. Ronen Bergman is a senior correspondent for military and intelligence affairs for Yediot Ahronot, Israel's largest paid newspaper. He is also a contributor to the New York Times Magazine, where he reports on intelligence, national security, terrorism, and nuclear issues. Bergman is a member of the Israeli Bar and has a master's degree in international relations and a PhD in history from Cambridge University. He is the author of several books, his most recent being Rise and Kill First, The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassinations. Ronen Bergman joined us via Skype from Tel Aviv. Ronen Bergman, thank you very much for coming to In Contrast. It's a pleasure to be talking to you about your most recent book, Rise and Kill First, The Secret History of Israel's Targeted Assassinations. This is an extraordinarily detailed, almost surgical analysis of the covert operations, of the targeted assassinations that the state of Israel has been doing even before the creation of the state. Before I enter the book, I would like to ask you about your role as a journalist. In this book, the role is almost to antagonize the state, to present information that might even be considered dangerous, existentially dangerous for the Jewish state. How did you come to take this particular approach?
First, Ilan, thank you for inviting me to your show. It's an honor and a pleasure. And I must say, I'm very happy and thrilled and positively surprised to some extent as per the warm welcoming that Rise and Kill First received by the American media. So for most of my life, I have been a journalist, and for most of my professional life as a journalist, I have been covering topics of national security, intelligence, military, terrorism, nuclear topics. And one of the main reasons, I think, that I have been doing that was thanks to the fact that so little was known about this world. So from the point of view of a journalist writing articles, reports in Israel, and to my fortunate, in the last 10 years outside of Israel, I've been working for the Spiegel in Germany and mainly for the New York Times, where I'm a contributing writer. This is like working in unknown virgin territory. And the stories that you find in this unknown territory are just amazing. And it's not just very, very interesting, amazing. Some of them are good, some of them are bad, but amazing stories. But there's something much more important than that, and that is you cannot really understand the history of Israel. That's the history of the region, sometimes the history of the world, without understanding the secrets of the history of Israeli intelligence and defense establishment. Because I think that in more than any other country in the Western world post-Second World War, the influence of Israeli intelligence on the history of the country is profound. There is not a single event. And again, without judging whether this is a good event or the decision was good or the development was positive or negative for mankind, but there is no one development, there is no one important decision, there is no one important operation. There is not one historical event in the lifetime of the country that is going to celebrate 70, that Israeli intelligence and defense establishment did not take part of. And therefore, if you want to look for a test, this is what I see as my life task, to bring about the fact to have a better reading for the history of Israeli intelligence, therefore helping have a much better and accurate reading of Israeli history at large.
Of course, Ronen, the conundrum that you are presenting is that while you are doing an enormous service to the readership, to the international community, in offering a variety of historical facts, you are dealing, as you're stressing, with secrets. And the Mossad and the Israeli armed forces, according to the way you presented, and I have no doubt, did everything in their power to undermine your access to the information, because making that information not a secret anymore would put in jeopardy the very operations they'd make. So the conundrum here is, as long as this remains a secret, it can continue to be performed. The moment it becomes revealed, the very foundation of these strategic assassinations are put in question. How do you deal with that double level?
These organizations, of course, they prefer to act in the dark. They prefer, and this is just natural. I assume that if I was with these organizations, then I would do the same and prefer the same, and even do what's possible to maybe disrupt the work of a journalist who wants to publish this. But at the end of the day, I believe that when the organizations sometimes fight against these attempts to research the history, individuals of these organizations, and here is where one of the secrets of the book, individuals do cooperate because they think that these stories should be published. And if you look at the bibliography, you'll see that I have been able to interview around 1,000 people, many of them veterans of Israeli intelligence or people of active duty, most of them interviewed on the record. And you see Minister of Defense, Prime Minister, Chiefs of Staff, Chiefs of the Mossad, Chief of the Shin Bet, the domestic secret service, through the chain of command, through the commanders of operations, through the intelligence officers, and the operatives on the field. These people feel that after so many years in the service, the time has come to tell the stories. And after 8 years of research, we have come with this book, Rise and Kill First, that for the first time is able to tell the stories while hopefully also giving a broader perspective. And all that is based on many, many, many oral testimonies and many, many, many documents that were never published before. And while corroborating this huge database, putting the facts in order.
The epigraph of the book comes from the Babylonian Talmud, from the tractate Sanhedrin. If someone comes to kill you, rise up and kill him first. In many ways, I think your book is a vivid expression of what happens after 1948. But the early parts of the book are about how, during the British protectorate of Palestine, groups like the Irgun were active in creating these political assassinations that you refer to, in that one of the efforts of David Ben-Gurion, the first president of Israel, was to acquiesce, to stop those fringe forces in order to create a much more leveled and normal society. Tell me a bit about Ben-Gurion's approach to Irgun and to the idea of eliminating voices that were dangerous or undermining the idea of the Jewish state.
David Ben-Gurion, whom I believe was the most important Jew in the last at least 1,000 years, was very keen to have one voice, one authority, one centralized leadership, what they called the Yeshuv, the Jews inside Palestine, which was until 1948 under the rule of the British Mandate. And there were other, the Irgun was for most of the time commanded by Menachem Begin, or the Stern Gang, the Fighters for the Freedom of Israel. They were called the Stern Gang after the first leader, Abraham Stern. And then he was killed by the Brits and was succeeded by Yitzhak Shamir, who was later the Israeli Prime Minister. So these were two splinter groups that were by far more radical than the Haganah, that was the main underground Yeshuv movement. And they supported to take a much more extreme actions against the British in order to try and expel them from Palestine, and against the Arabs who challenged the rights of the Jews to have an independent state upon that land. And Ben-Gurion was trying to diminish and disassemble the organizations. And he did that with various methods that were very, very controversial at the time. And I would say that history just made them more controversial. One of these methods was to execute traitors, people who surrendered the information to the Brits, to the Arabs, or even to the other organization. One of them was to give the British intelligence about the other organizations. And the main informer who was sent by David Ben-Gurion to give that information was the one who was codenamed by British intelligence Agent Scorpio, and that was Teddy Kollek, the legendary mayor of Jerusalem. So Ben-Gurion was taking firm steps. He himself thought that, for example, until 1945, until the end of the Second World War, he thought the Jews should not employ methods of what they call personal terror, assassination. But all that changed after it became clear what were the horrific results of the Second World War, the Holocaust. And the Holocaust changed the law. And Ben-Gurion, while fighting the existence of these radical groups who were not under his command, eventually disassembling them after the establishment of Israel, Ben-Gurion took a more aggressive approach when it came to methods that needs to be exploited and deployed to achieve independence and preserve the security of the Jews in Palestine and later the Israelis in Israel. That included targeted killings. He changed this policy. That was, I think, if I want to generalize, what were the main lessons that Ben-Gurion, as well as all the other Israelis, the new Jews who came from the Holocaust, who were already in Palestine, established the state of Israel. I think that they drew three main lessons from the Holocaust. First is that there will always be a goy, a Gentile, who is after the Jews to kill them, to perform the second annihilation, another more Holocaust. The second is that the other Gentiles, the other goyim, would do nothing to help the Jews and maybe even join the first goy to trying to kill them. And the third one is that the Jews should have a homeland, should have a refuge, should have Israel, and protect that with whatever mean possible. Now, when you have this as your main historical lesson, even trauma, and in every decade of your independency, your prime nemesis, your main adversary, your big enemy, declares that he wants to eliminate you. You know, President Nasser of Egypt, Yasser Arafat of the PLO, Saddam Hussein of Iraq, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad of Iran. They all declare that they want to destroy the state of Israel and expel or kill the Jews. When you put all this on one table, you end up with the phrase that also consists the name of the book. Comes from the Babylonian Talmud. When someone comes to kill you, rise up and kill him first. And that phrase was used by many, many, many of my 1,000 interviewees. When someone comes to kill you, rise up and kill him first, as a mindset, as a doctrine, as a defense perception that you attribute less to diplomacy and to international norms and sovereignty and laws. But when your main threat is annihilation, you rise up and kill him first, and kill him first.
Staying with Ben-Gurion, the book details thousands of targeted political assassinations that go from before the creation of the State of Israel to the very present. In a state, by the way, that doesn't have the death penalty, and I will return to this in a second, but there is an extraordinary paradigm that happens in the late 50s, beginning of the 60s, again with Ben-Gurion and in connection with the Holocaust, when an Israeli commando kidnaps Adolf Eichmann in Buenos Aires, brings him back to Israel, and puts him on trial and finds him guilty, and eventually he is condemned to death by hanging. This is a fascinating moment for a variety of reasons. This is the moment in which Israel has the opportunity to show the world that it is a modern nation, that it will bring to justice those that have gone against the Jews. But it also presents a curious paradigm in that this is not a political assassination. This is a kidnapping that brings the target to the State of Israel to create a court that will put that individual on trial. To what extent that idea could remain viable and could have been used in the case of other individuals that the Mossad and other organizations targeted and ultimately killed, and instead would have been brought to Israel, maybe stand on trial, maybe create some sort of discourse about their career in trying to destroy the State of Israel, and not working with blood, but working with justice. What is the Eichmann story so different?
The Eichmann story was a unique moment in history where operational and intelligence capability converged with the historical will of the Jewish people and its representative, the State of Israel, for retribution. And the hidden will of David Ben-Gurion, not just to show the world that Israel is bringing Nazis to justice, not just taking revenge, but also show the world that after being accused that during the 40s, when he was still an underground leader, he did not do enough for the Jews in the Holocaust. This is one of the main controversies in the history of Israel, was the issue of doing enough to help the Jews in Europe. Of course, they didn't do that. The Holocaust is happening. But Ben-Gurion wanted to send its intelligence service, the Mossad, to bring Eichmann, say, here's the guy who was managing the Wannsee conference on the final solution, and we are bringing him to justice. So Ben-Gurion was, in a way, trying to also overcome some criticism that was launched against him. People of Israeli intelligence, in many, many, many cases where they ended up with killing someone, would actually prefer to have that person being in an interrogation cell so he could bring much information. They wouldn't prefer to kill him, but it is so much easier to kill someone than to arrest him. In fact, when the Supreme Court of Israel in 2006 published their ruling on the legality of targeted killing, they adopted one of the main principles that the Shin Bet presented to them as a criteria for performing targeted killing. And that criteria was that there is no reasonable alternative to perform an arrest. If we take what happened to Eichmann, we could say that in the Eichmann case, though, of course, in 1960, the Supreme Court never dreamt there would be one day that they would deal with these issues. But if we used our time tunnel, and we would go jumping from 2006 to 1960, we would say that in that case, that employed that criteria and said, we are able to bring Adolf Eichmann to face an Israeli court for what he did in the execution of the final solution. But in all other cases, or in many of them, the vast majority, the assassination took place in remote places and hostile areas, in countries that wouldn't allow the Mossad to work, didn't want to arrest, sometimes gave a very friendly shelter to the terrorists, sometimes didn't care for the information Israel supplied them that terrorists are working on their soil because they wanted to be seen as neutral. And so Israel didn't see other choice than to arrest these people. There are, of course, all these cases that in retrospect, Israel could perform differently. But the mindset at the time when the operation was executed was that there is no other alternative. There is a viable risk from a person. And the only way to stop the bad doing of that person is to kill it.
A targeted assassination is not only the killing of an individual, but it comes with political ramifications, obviously. In the case of Eichmann, for instance, one of the things that is very intriguing is that within Jewish history, the kidnapping of Eichmann is seen as an enormous triumph. The possibility of Ben-Gurion bringing this terrible Nazi orchestrator to Israel to put him on trial, to show the world that Israel is a democracy and a nation, and that whoever goes against the Jewish people will pay the consequences. But outside of the Jewish people, in Argentina, for instance, or in Chile, or in Uruguay, or in Bolivia, Paraguay, there is, to this day, a very long-standing reaction to the kidnapping of Eichmann, to such extent that it has created something that is called planandinia, that suggests that Israel has been buying territories in the Patagonia because it is unhappy with the situation in the Middle East. It knows that will never come to peace with its neighbors and ultimately will want to relocate to Latin America, to this distant corner where nobody will bother it. As fanciful, as imaginative as this idea is, it all connects with the concept that the Israelis are meddling in other nations' affairs and that quietly that is also done not only through politics but through acquisition of territories, etc. So one of the fascinating elements of your book is that the person who's responsible for giving the yes or no in these decisions to do the targeted assassinations is the prime minister. In many ways, the prime minister is in Israel is choosing how to deal with his enemies and also having the consequences that this will bring along. what does one do with the repercussions of those assassinations, knowing that they are ordered by whoever is sitting in the role of the prime minister?
The first one who needs to take care and consider the repercussion is the prime minister. As the leader of the state, as the one who is in charge of Israeli politics and Israeli policy, the one who is in charge of the international stand of Israel worldwide, the only one who is entitled to, okay, targeted killing, then Israeli prime minister has to take into consideration what are going to be the political implication of every operation. You asked about conspiracy theories that Israel is buying land in Patagonia. These are all false. And I think that they are connected to the Eichmann kidnapping and possible some other operations that Israel did in South America involving other Nazi criminals like Klaus Barbie or Joseph Mengele. But they are also connected on a broader sense to the belief that the Jews are omnipotent and can do everything everywhere, to the protocols of the Elder of Zion, and to huge belief in old narratives of anti-Semitism. And I'm not sure that if Eichmann wouldn't have been kidnapped and executed, these conspiracy theories wouldn't be growing anyway. And there's also another thing. One of the targets of Mossad, of Israeli intelligence, was not just to eliminate certain people throughout time, but also to create deterrence. And so the Mossad as a policy never denied or acknowledged, never did take responsibility, never fought with whatever was published about him, even if much of what was published is not true. There's a book in England that was, I think, even a bestseller about the Mossad that said that Monica Lewinsky was the Mossad operation. This is considered to be a serious book. A lot of people worldwide know what they know about the Mossad from this book that claims that the Israeli establishment thought that President Clinton was not positive enough for Israel, so they sent Monica Lewinsky to frame him in order to impeach him. I have someone from Mossad. He said, I wish that we had this kind of capabilities and originality. As insane and as absurd and as lunatic these stories were, Mossad profited because it just empowered the image of being efficient and ruthless. Even Mossad real screw-ups, from the botched operation in Lillehammer through the botched operation in Amman in 1997 trying to kill Khaled Mashal, to the botched operation in Dubai in 2010, all these operations just amplified the legend and the myth of Mossad. And if there's something I think that maybe infuriates some people of Israeli intelligence about my book, is that in some sense, what I do is demystifying the Mossad. So I put things in order. These are real people, as all people are, with good things, with bad things, with capabilities, with vice and virtue. This is what they did very good. This is where they got it wrong. And sometimes Israeli intelligence operations are really unbelievable, more than anything that we saw in the movies, more than anything that we saw in 007 in James Bond. But sometimes the Israeli James Bond looks, I would say, more than like more Inspector Clouseau.
Ronan, we're coming to an end here of our show, and I have a couple of questions to conclude. The first one is, you do an enormously detailed job exploring the targeted assassinations that didn't succeed in ending Yasser Arafat's, the PLO leader, his life. And you leave this open. I wonder if the rumors that still exist to this day and that have brought the body, the remains, back to surface, that he was poisoned and that he was poisoned by the Israelis, have any merit?
As I wrote, there were many considerations and dilemmas and debates what to do with Yasser Arafat when he was identified by Israeli intelligence, by his own writings, as were captured by the Israeli Defense Forces, being part of the problem and not part of the solution. That is during the Second Intifada from 2001 until his mysterious demise in 2004. So there were people who thought he should be expelled to a lonely island. Some people thought he should be staying to rot in his headquarters in Ramallah. And some people thought he should be killed. These rumors reached the White House, and in April of 2004, President Bush, in a meeting with Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, said, Mr. Prime Minister, I want you to promise me, to assure me, that you are not going to kill Yasser Arafat, a thing that we believe should not be done. And Ariel Sharon looked at the president, whom he respected very much and had very good relations with, and said, Mr. President, I see your point. Now, President Bush understood that this is all but a promise. So he said, okay, thank you, but Mr. Prime Minister, please promise me. So Errol Sharon said something like, well, Mr. President, I really understand where you come from. And again, he did not reply. And the president did not leave the issue until Prime Minister Errol Sharon promised him that he's not going to kill Yasser Arafat. Now, after such a promise is given, of course, if Israel had anything to do with the death of Yasser Arafat, this should have been done the most secretive and isolated forum. And as I wrote in the book, if that indeed happened, then I wouldn't be able to tell you the answer to the question, and you can draw whatever conclusion you want from what I just said. But if you read what Ariel Sharon himself, without acknowledging Israeli involvement, said after the mysterious demise of Arafat, when he said that the region looks much better without Arafat, and his successors, the President Mahmoud Abbas and Prime Minister Salem Fayyad, are people with whom he himself, you know, the warmonger, Ariel Sharon believed that a solution can be reached, you will understand what Ariel Sharon thought of the benefit that everybody could get from the death of Yasser Arafat.
And last, Ronen, there is an important part of your book where you talk about how the United States has learned from Israel and has engaged in the past 2 decades in targeted assassinations. Of course, the Osama bin Laden is the most celebrated one, but there are many others. Whereas Israel can engage in thousands, the United States, as you put it, has been doing 200 or 300. The question that I have for you as our conversation comes to an end is, in presenting such a detailed and meticulous description of these operations by the Mossad and others, is there a possibility that not only the United States will follow suit, as it has, but Israel's enemies developing systems that can target Israeli and Jewish figures? It has already in the past, but in a much more systematic way, and become a good student, so to speak.
I think that many of Israeli adversaries have done whatever they think they could to harm Israel, and that the reaction to use assassination or targeted killings was to the most extreme means that were already employed by Israeli enemies. So if you want to make a comparison, the jihadist Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad were launching a severe, horrific campaign of suicide terrorism to kill women and children and men, all civilians in the streets of Israel. So against that, Israel was launching a targeted killing campaign to kill not the suicide bomber themselves, but the people above them in the hierarchy, the bomb makers, the recruiters, the indoctrinators, the drivers, the regional commanders and the political leaders. And so it seems to me that many of Israeli adversaries have used non-targeted killings in masses, and Israel reacted with their weapon of choice, and in some cases proved to be very effective. You mentioned that the United States have learned a lot from Israeli intelligence and Israeli operational experience in targeted killing that was happening mainly after September 11. And after the United States started to use the same tactics, of course, American euphemism is targeted killing, not assassinations. You know, assassinations are forbidden by U.S. law. Mm-hmm. Targeted killing are permitted. I think it means the same, but currently the legal advisors to American intelligence think that there's a difference. In any case, if there's a voice coming from this book or some broader conclusion, is that when learning about Israeli tactical successes and taking much of Israeli experience and developments of weapons, of means of communication, command and control, and others, the U.S. also needs to learn and to look about the political and moral price that Israel has paid and still paying for the employment of these tactics. While I do believe that in many cases, the use of targeted killing and assassination has been effective, has proved to be saving human lives on both sides, has proved to be able to achieve goals. For example, to stop the Hamas from performing any more suicide killings, suicide terrorism, because they realize that if they continue, they jeopardize their existence because their commanders have been killed daily. Israel was the first and I think the only country that was able to take down a jihadist organization on its knees, begging for ceasefire and stopping what was considered to be unstoppable suicide terrorism. At the same time, I believe that the use of that weapon has also created a problem. The bottom line, if you're looking for some bottom line, there are a few, but one of the main ones is that Israeli intelligence is arguably the best intelligence community in the world. Sooner or later, they have the Mossad, the Shin Bet, the military intelligence have been able to supply Israeli leaders with solutions to all the challenges that they have presented to Israeli spies and operatives. But Israeli leaders drew, I think, sometimes the wrong conclusions from these successes. They believe that at the tip of the fingers, they have a powerful tool, not just to prevent the next day suicide killing, not just to save human lives, not just, you know, to delay the Iranian nuclear project advancement, but also to stop history. They believe that they have the power to do whatever they need in pinpoint operation way beyond enemy lines without resorting to other more risky and more complicated methods like diplomacy, like statesmanship, like discourse, like speaking with the enemy. And therefore, I think that the bottom line is that the story of Israeli intelligence is a story of unbelievable series of tactical successes, really, really great stories, but at the same time of a dangerous political strategic failure.
The failure to engage in diplomacy.
The failure to understand that the use of force has limits. And at the end of the day, even if you win the battlefield, even if you take down a jihadist movement on its knees and they stop using suicide bombers, then the next step needs to be diplomacy, because you cannot stop history and you cannot just resort to the use of force. You need to use statesmanship. You need to have a political vision. That is the danger in being so successful.
Ronen Bergman, it has been extraordinarily enlightening to have this conversation with you. I appreciate enormously you coming to In Contrast. Thank you. Shalom.
Thank you. Shalom. Thank you so much.
When is violence acceptable? Is it when we resort to it in self-defense? Socrates, who is considered the father of Western philosophy, said never. If one suffers from an attack, reacting to it in violence, that is, lowering ourselves to the level of one's aggressors, is a statement of inhumanity. And humanity is what makes us who we are. The capacity to resist, to refuse the eye for an eye approach. Socrates' view is lofty, idealistic, but it fails to recognize our most instinctual facet, the need to assert our ground, to protect ourselves. I believe what qualifies beings is the intrinsic desire for self-preservation. Even in the worst of scenarios, our drive is to remain who we are. This not only pertains to individuals, families, groups, collectivities, and nations exist through self-preservation. Italians want to be Italian, not French, Portuguese, Scandinavian, or Venezuelan. They do so by showcasing their traits, which include language and cuisine and folklore, athletics, humor, art, and so on. There are constant threats to that heritage, and the natural response is to defend it, that is, to perpetuate it by any means. Defending ourselves, of course, can be turned into an enterprise. In other words, one's whole heritage, if perceived under a constant state of danger, turns self-preservation into an all-consuming endeavor. We exist in order to survive, and we survive in order to exist. Since its inception, the State of Israel has seen the need to defend itself. Attacks come in all kinds of ways, from individual acts of targeted violence, what we call terrorism, to outright war. Attacks also come in the form of delegitimization. No other modern nation's existence is constantly put into question the way Israel is. Self-defense can numb you. It can make you immune to other people's suffering. It can turn you into a machine. Violence begets violence. Unfortunately, peace doesn't beget peace, because peace is harder to achieve. It takes more effort. In order to make peace, you have to reach a particular state of mind in which you finally see your existence not threatened, and as a result, you are ready to stop attacking others who refuse to recognize your right to exist. This equilibrium is surely elusive, but it is not impossible. Next time on In Contrast.
Whatever we want to call success for a person of color in this country is never far from precarity. You could be the darling today, and you could be completely demolished tomorrow.
Juno Diaz on the next In Contrast. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. Our interns include Delina Hatku and Jacob Pagano. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.